Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host, Tim Henney. Well, today in the program, we'll speak about a little known concept, I think. It's a breast milk donation bank. It's taking shape right now at the Park City Medical Center. Nikki Thorson and Taylor Hanton will join us to talk about how these breast milk banks can save lives.
Good morning, Lynn. And then it's Aspen Mattis who joins us to share Girl in the Woods, her memoir of trauma and salvation.
This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Carolyn with Alpine Apothecary. Mountain Life hosts Lynn and Tim and their guests help to keep us feeling and looking good. With skincare products made in our lab, using ingredients provided by Mother Nature, we help keep skin feeling and looking good. Alpine Apothecary, specialty pharmacy, taking care of the skin you're in.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, celebrating 25 years in Park City. San Francisco Design is happy to sponsor public affairs programming on KPCW. For 25 years, we have been providing home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. We're located on Bonanza Drive and at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. It's the weekly program about health, nutrition, fitness, and lifestyle in general. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Well, the Park City Medical Center is in the process of becoming a breast milk donation center. What is that, you may ask? Well, babies who are premature or have other severe illnesses need human milk to thrive, and sometimes their mamas cannot produce it or enough of it for one reason or another. So breast milk donation centers are set up to bank this precious and life-giving liquid. And joining us to talk about it are the two who are leading the way. It's Nikki Thorson. She's a nurse educator for women and newborns, and Taylor Hanton, a neonatal nurse practitioner. And good morning to both of you, and thanks for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And you'll want to get right up close to the microphones there. So, this is such an interesting concept, and I think I've been aware that these exist. I had no idea that the Park City Medical Center was setting one up. So how widespread are, you know, do you have one in almost every hospital, a breast milk donation center? Is it rare?
So the main center right now is in Colorado. Utah is working on setting up their own Mountain West Milk Bank in Salt Lake City. They predicted it would be done in 2016. So right now, Intermountain is setting up a lot of satellite donation centers so we can start collecting milk. And right now we're sending it to Colorado to be processed. But in 2016, hopefully we'll be sending it to Salt Lake so we can distribute more locally.
Processed.
Yeah, processed.
What are the sort of mechanics of this whole thing? You collect and then it has to go to a central location in Colorado. So
is it pasteurized?
Yes. So what we do is we collect milk from moms. So once mom has been approved to be a donor, they will come into the Park City Medical Center, have a blood test their first time dropping off their milk, and then we will collect their milk from them and then store it, and then we ship it in 24 hours to Colorado, and then it's pasteurized. So 95% of the milk, what's contained in the milk, is kept during the pasteurization process, so all the immunology properties and nutrients are preserved into the milk, and all the bad things like bacteria and viruses are pasteurized out of it. So then once they clean the milk, they store it in Colorado, and then they distribute it across the U.S.
And they distribute it frozen?
Yes. Yep. And it's mostly done delivered to NICUs, because that's where premature babies, so newborn intensive care units. I work for Intermountain's NICUs in the Valley, and we use frozen human milk for the majority of our patients.
And why is that? Does it have to do with the amount of milk that the mother, the biological mother, is producing, or it's not sufficient, or it's not the right kind of milk that is needed for an infant that is in the NICU?
most of the babies that are in the NICUs are premature. And so when you have a premature baby, when you're talking about a 25-week baby, so gestation age of 25 weeks, their guts are pretty immature as well. And so when we put formulas and the proteins that are in formulas, that can be really hard for the babies to digest. And so the best thing and the easiest thing for those premature babies to digest is human milk. And sometimes when they're born that early, it's hard for moms to get a milk supply. And then it's very demanding to continue to get that milk supply when their baby's in the newborn intensive care unit. We know that moms that are under stress, it's hard for them to keep their milk production up. And so now when you have a, you know, 1-pound baby in the NICU, it's a very stressful situation. Moms usually have other kids at home. They're trying to live a double life as far as taking care of their baby in the NICU, but also being home for their kids. So it's a very demanding pumping schedule that they have to continue not only during the daytime, but during the night as well. So a lot of times the moms that are in the NICU or have a baby in the NICU can't keep up with the demand of their baby.
And how long has it been going on that the practice has been? I mean, I guess the practice at one point you said was formula.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the best practice. And then it was determined that because you weren't having the success or there was a greater need, so sort of that demand-driven side of it, which was to help the infants in the ICU, what is it, the INCU?
The NICU.
The NICU?
Yes.
The infants in the NICU, that this would be a better way. So when did that come about? Is this recent or?
You know, we've always known that breast milk is best,
right,
for babies, especially preterm babies. But I want to say, you know, breast milk banks have been around for like 100 years from what I've been told. Intermountain is probably within the last 5 to 10 years. It's a little bit been a little bit more apparent, and we've been using it more. You know, we have to go through a lot of protocols and make sure that the milk is clean. So we want to make sure that we're, you know, not harming our babies. But within the last 5 to 10 years, we were using it a lot more. And now it's our first choice. So if we have babies that are born less than a certain weight, we will give them pasteurized human milk if moms aren't able to produce their own.
Mm.
And how do you administer the milk to a premature baby who is, you know, I would assume, incapable of doing things that full gestation babies are capable of doing?
So just in general, the whole suck, swallow, breathing reflex in babies occurs between 32 and 34 weeks gestation. So those babies that are less than that aren't able to suck and swallow the milk appropriately. So with those babies, we put a tube down into their stomach. So either into their mouth and goes into their stomach, or in their nose and goes into their stomach. So for those babies, we will start a very small volume of feeding. We call them trophic feedings, that just kind of helps the gut get used to having food in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why just a very small volume of milk is needed to keep, to help the babies digest it. So we could use, say, 20 mils, so not even a full ounce of milk could feed a preterm baby for like 3 days, because we're only giving them a teaspoon every 3 hours. And that's enough just to get their stomachs used to having something in there that's totally benign and helpful for their immune system.
Wow. So they don't have anything else other than that 1 ounce over 3 days. Do they have water? Do they have?
No, well, we give it to them like every 3 hours. So they'll have like a teaspoon.
It's like feeding a baby bird or
something.
Yeah,
it really is. And then, you know, we have to wait for them to kind of digest that milk and make sure that they are urinating and stooling appropriately before we can increase the amount of milk they get.
Hmm. This is fascinating. So for any of our listeners who have never been either a breastfeeding mom or the dad who has to sometimes, you know, be left with a screaming baby when there's no milk and hoping the mom had pumped milk before she left and all of that.
She left forever.
Yeah. Exactly. I remember those days. Really, I'm just going to the grocery store 3 hours later. You know, it's kind of it's an odd sort of conversation, but it's really fascinating. So, Nikki, you know, looking back at my days of breastfeeding, you know, there was never any extra. So who are these people that are, you know, producing so much that they would actually have an extra ounce here and there, or an extra 10 ounces.
So some moms will pump what's called like power pumping. So they'll pump when they're getting ready to go back to work, or you know, they think they want to pump, and then they realize they don't need all the milk that they've pumped, and they have a freezer full of milk. And so one of the issues that Taylor actually had when she had a baby was she had a freezer full of milk and didn't know what to do with it. So she
threw it away.
Which is, you know, now we say, oh my gosh, wow, that milk could have saved how many babies? I mean, how many ounces of milk do you think you threw away?
Well, I didn't have that much.
It wasn't gallons.
It wasn't gallons,
but enough.
Nikki.
Because, you know, we said.
But enough that, I mean, it could have been very helpful for maybe half the NICU.
Right.
That's a lot of babies. So a breast milk donor is any healthy lactating woman with milk in excess of their own baby's needs. So they have to be able to donate a minimum of 150 mils or 5 ounces of milk over a 6-month period. So that's not that much milk in excess of what their baby needs. Anybody that's pumping and either they've weaned their baby from, you know, breast milk sooner than they thought and they have an excess of milk, or they choose that they want to donate milk, so they pump to donate.
So they have to, though, you said there's an outside time limit of 18 months since you first began mm-hmm. lactating. Because is that the milk that has the most nutrients or what?
After 18 months, it's the nutrient factor becomes more of an issue. So they will use milk that's frozen. So if, say, a mom has a baby that's 1 year they can still, and they have frozen milk, they can still donate that milk that they've already pumped. The issue becomes more of if they've been taking any medications and that would be contained in that milk. So what we are recommending is that any mom who thinks that they're a potential donor or has milk, that we'll refer them to the milk bank, and then they will do the screening process and determine if that milk is safe to use and safe to donate.
So does that mean anybody who's nursing their children after 18 months, it's not really from a practical standpoint of putting the immune components into their child? It's actually just for fun?
No comment.
Because I know that breastfeeding goes on. You know, there's a whole big, I guess there's a lot of different opinions on how long women breastfeed and are supposed to and what's appropriate or what's accepted.
Yeah, and what's healthy and what's,
healthy? I mean, I guess mm-hmm. that's where it stems from. What's
healthy? The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends for the first year is where they see the most benefit.
And I think it's great always to refer to your pediatrician or healthcare provider, and as long as your child is getting the nutrients and, you know, things that it needs, whatever you feel is best for your baby.
They're usually eating by that time,
yes,
too. So they're getting their nutrients from food as right. well as from the breast milk, where initially it's just breast milk.
Okay. So, and this is an interesting question that brings up, I remember, you know, back when I had babies, there was some talk about delaying solid foods. This may not be your area of expertise, but I'm curious because they used to say that if you delayed any solid foods, your child would have a less preponderance towards allergies. And then I just read something really recently that showed new research says the earlier you introduce your kid, your baby, to real food, the fewer allergies they'll have. What's your opinion on that? It's so strange. It's exactly contradictory.
I've also seen the research swinging back and forth. And I think, again, we'd always defer back to your pediatrician or healthcare provider. But I think that, you know, there is a lot of good research on breastfeeding. And so our biggest message here is that breastfeeding is a great thing to do for your babies. And as far as the length of feeding, I think you can find research on anything. You can find research to support breastfeeding for 3 years. You can find research saying breastfeeding should be, you know, stopped within the first 6 months and solid foods, you know, and start it. But I think what we know is that breastfeeding is what's best for your baby. And if you can breastfeed, that is a great thing to do.
And at this point, the demand for breast milk far outweighs our supply that we have. And so that's why we'd like to give it to not just preterm babies, but term babies that may be in the NICU that are sick. We'd like to offer them breast milk as well. And at this point, we're just not able to meet the demand of all the babies that should get breast milk.
And I wanted to ask you about that. just that supply side, because there's obviously the demand that outstrips the supply. Mm-hmm. So how have moms in the past found out about these donation banks? Or is it something that really isn't widely known amongst the population of moms? Is this new information about breast milk donation banks?
When I had, you know, my daughter's 8 now, and like I said, I threw away my milk. So, I mean, and I work in the newborn intensive care. So I didn't know that it was a possibility or where to get that information. So I think within the last 5-ish years, it's becoming more apparent. And we're doing these satellite donation centers, and it's becoming a lot more public knowledge than what it had been before.
And then does it have something to do also with the fact that we're putting more resources into trying to help prematurely born infants or even any other infants that are in the intensive care units? It seems like, you know, infant mortality 50 years ago, babies died for various reasons, and now we have all this new technology where we can, you know, help them in ways that we weren't able to before. And therefore, if you're helping those children, all of a sudden you need to feed them.
Right. Well, that's a big part of it, too, is that we're able to save younger and younger babies. But I think the other piece of that is that we've seen the success that we've had with babies tolerating human milk over preterm formulas. You know, the formulas that we feed our preterm babies are different than term formulas. They have different proteins and different nutrients because those babies need different things to grow, and they need more calories because they don't have the extra fat that term babies do. So when we started using human milk, we've seen the success at how well those babies were able to tolerate that milk and continued to eat and grow. So we can still add extra nutrients and calories to the pasteurized human milk, so it's not straight breast milk all the time, but the base of it and the proteins are much better digested by these preterm babies. And babies that have gut issues. So babies that have had surgery, term babies that have had surgeries on their intestines also benefit from human milk because they also have a harder time digesting formulas. So this is something that just when a baby is really sick, they, you know, when you're not feeling well, you don't want to go eat a turkey sandwich. You want just some broth. And this is kind of what it is for the babies. Like, it's just a nice, easily digestible food that they don't have to work too hard to digest because it's human.
Mm. So no matter really what you think about how long one should breastfeed or any of those things, it comes back to the science that nature is best and what a human produces to feed the child. You know, it's just how we were designed. Mm-hmm. And so this is really interesting to see that for these premature and sick babies, that it's human milk. It's really you cannot mimic human milk with a manufactured product.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yep, you just can't do it.
Yeah. So how do you advertise? I suppose you go to the lactation. What's the La Leche League?
Uh huh. You know, when we first were trying to promote the breast milk donation center in Park City, I looked to see if there's like a local La Leche League. And I know there was at one point, from what I saw, I didn't see anything that was a current one. So just thinking of, you know, pediatricians' offices, the OB offices.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Patients that deliver at the hospital, we let them know. Friends of friends type of a...
Patient education.
Yeah.
They're doing a lot more. You can go to our Facebook page at Park City Medical Center. And there's more information there. Intermountain, as I previously mentioned, is setting up a lot of satellite donation centers. So if you don't live in Park City and it's easier for you to drop off milk in Salt Lake, there's several options there as well. So Intermountain has been really pushing it and setting up these sites to get ready for the milk bank in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And the other really cool thing that Park City Medical Center is doing is that they're donating the cost of the blood draw. They're writing it off and donating it to the mother's milk bank because it's pretty much, it doesn't cost anything to get the milk. The only thing they charge is for the processing fees and shipping fees. So it's a nonprofit organization. So it was a really cool thing that Park City Medical Center kind of wrote that cost off for the mother's milk bank to do all the blood draws.
Mm. Yeah, that's really nice. So in order to evaluate the milk, well, first you do this blood test and the obvious things like hepatitis, HIV. Mm-hmm. What else might be in your blood that would preclude you?
There are some medications that the the milk bank in Denver will do a screening for. I don't know if you know specifically the medications, Taylor. I think I've heard comments from parents who had tried to donate that were, you know, maybe frustrated that, you know, oh, I took one Tylenol and they said I couldn't. I don't know that that's necessarily the case, but I think that there are definitely some medications and supplements that they may say, you know what, we can't use your milk.
Or they'll have you, if a mom is taking a certain medication and she takes it, you know, once a day, they will have her not donate that batch of milk and then use the milk after that medication is cleared. But they, that's part of the screening process they do in education, the milk bank does with the potential donor as far as what medications you're on, what herbs, because we don't have a lot of research on certain herbs and they can be pretty detrimental to babies. So they will do a more in-depth screening on that, and then they'll work with the mom on if you're taking this regularly, what milk can we use and what milk do we prefer to not donate to our babies, just because they are preterm and they are sick babies. And you'd have to be really careful about what we're putting into their systems, because they're clearing mechanisms. So their kidneys and livers are also premature. So they just can't handle some
it
of those
has to
extra
be so
things.
Pure. So probably if you're on antidepressants or something like that, it's not going to fly. Some daily
probably
medication.
Probably not, but that's what we refer to the milk bank, because there's so many different ones out there and there's so many different medications and so many different herbs that that's what they're experts on and that's what they screen for.
Right. This is such interesting information.
I just keep thinking about the little baby with the hose down its nose, the tube. I'm not going to call it a hose.
It's very small.
It's very small. Tiny hose.
Well, delivering
tube.
Just literally drops of milk.
That's really
So you also say that a sample of the milk is analyzed to assess the fats, proteins, and lactose. Is there ever light shed on a lactating mom who's feeding her own baby? And then you say, well, wait a minute, your milk's no good. And they go, what? You know, like it doesn't have enough proteins or
no, they
fats
it's
or...
just basically to give us a general idea on what the nutrition is that we're providing the babies. So mom's milk can differ on the caloric content depending on if it's the beginning of the feeding, the middle of the feeding, or into the feeding. And what's also pretty amazing about our bodies is that when a baby is born preterm, that milk is different than what a term baby's milk is.
Right.
So when they pasteurize the milk, they have like a baseline idea of what the nutrient content is to that milk. But really what it comes down to is once we're feeding that individual patient, is that particular baby able to grow? And if they're not growing, you know, steadily, then that's when we add additional nutrients and we do lab tests on that baby to make sure that their calcium and their phosphorus is adequate for bone growth. And we're making sure that they're getting enough vitamins. So we monitor those babies really closely to make sure that the milk that we are giving them is providing the needs.
Their needs. So those additional nutrients are, again, fats. And I mean, it's curious to me that, again, you're adding something in that's not natural, because that in turn sort of makes it like a formula. I realize it's a base of human milk.
So what we generally add is just what we call a fortifier. And so sometimes, you know, babies have a hard time digesting that too, but it's the base, which you just mentioned, which is seems to be the really important part. And so when you have the proteins that are human, even when we add additional calories to that milk and different fats like omega-3s, you know, they're essential fatty acids that sometimes isn't enough provided in the milk. So that's why we have to, in addition to giving the baby this pasteurized human milk, to make sure that it's enough nutrient-wise. Generally, breast milk is about 19 to 20 calories per ounce, and that's just not enough to have a preterm baby that has a lot of energy demands, not only just to digest the food, but to breathe, to eat, to keep the baby warm. That's why they're in incubators, because they spend so many calories just trying to keep their bodies warm. So we try to take some of that demand away from them, put them in a heated environment, so now they don't have to use their fat and energy to keep themselves warm. Now they can use that fat and energy just to breathe, to grow their lungs, to digest their food. And so anything we can do to make that process easier for that baby in the long run is going to benefit them.
And if you think of it, nothing about having a 26-weeker in the NICU is natural.
Right, right. How many babies are born prematurely, or, you know, before, and what do you consider premature? Is it pre-30 weeks?
Anything less than 37 weeks.
Oh, 37.
And we have different categories. We have extremely low birth weight. We have late preterm babies. Late preterm babies is like 34 to 36 weeks. And those babies are a unique population in the sense that sometimes they act like a preterm baby and sometimes they act more like a term baby. So they're in that the middle ground. Mm-hmm. So it... the number of preterm deliveries that we're having is increasing, and partly that's because we're able to care for much smaller babies.
Mm. Do we have lower birth weight babies up here at 7,000 feet?
No, not that, no. I don't, okay. No. No. The only thing we see at a higher elevation is sometimes the babies will have an oxygen need that they generally don't have at a lower elevation. So if you have a baby that's born in Park City versus a baby that's born in Boston, perhaps that baby, if they were born here, might have more of an oxygen requirement than what they would at sea level.
So if someone came from Boston and then had their baby in Park City, that baby may have issues. But typically our babies that have been gestated in Park City don't have any issues.
Okay. Okay. So you don't automatically hook them up to some oxygen.
Did you just say that there's... that there are more premature babies these days? Is that a trend where we're seeing more low birth weight babies?
It's not necessarily low birth weight babies. It's just that we're able to care for much smaller gestation babies.
Right.
So before, you know, we were able to, you know, 27 weeks was considered, oh, wow, a 27-weeker. But now we're down to like 24, 25 weeks. And that gets into a big... like a moral conflict, you know, just because we can, should we, and, you know, what are we doing? Is this the best thing for the baby? Is this the best thing for the family? So, you know, we educate and consult families on what this means, if, you know, if they were to deliver a baby that small, what it means for that baby and what it means for their, you know, future.
But you think that babies have always, the number of babies born at that period of time is remaining fairly constant, or and it's our ability to then care for them that has changed, so that's why there are more premature
babies.
My
gut would say what you said is probably accurate, but I don't know that we have any something to say absolutely yes. But definitely science has helped us to have NICUs that have babies that are 24, 25 weeks, where maybe 15 years ago that wasn't even possible.
Yeah. Well, Nikki and Taylor, it's really been a fascinating topic to speak with you about. I think really an important thing to end on is that women out there, lactating women, need to know that it doesn't take that much. Mm-hmm. An ounce can feed a premature baby for 3 days.
At least.
That's phenomenal. So yes, don't be like Taylor.
Just throw your milk away.
That's right. So they can call the Park City Medical Center, go on the Park City Medical Center website to look
their
you
Facebook
up,
page.
And they can Facebook page, and one of the two of you will get back, or someone will, and get those lactating ladies in. So this is really a wonderful program. And so when is it up and running already?
We've had our first
3 gallons of milk we've collected.
Wow.
And that's probably just been within the last month, 2 months.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And that's 2 moms.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay, so there is milk out there.
There is milk out there.
What's your daily demand?
Oh my gosh. I mean, if you just think of the NICUs that we have between Intermountain Medical Center, Utah Valley.
How about just right here in Park City?
Oh, just right here?
At the hospital.
It's, you know, we don't have those preterm babies up here.
Okay.
So our demand isn't that huge up here. But what we can do up here to provide for other families across the U.S. is pretty amazing.
Okay. Well, Nikki Thorson is a nurse educator for women and newborns. Taylor Hanton, a neonatal nurse practitioner. And we thank you so much for coming in today. It's been really interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And this is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll be speaking with Aspen Mattis. She's the author of a new book called Girl in the Woods, a really fascinating memoir, a little traumatic and victorious at the same time. So we'll be looking forward to speaking with her in just a moment. Stay with us.
I am Amy Roberts with Park City Medical Center, a not-for-profit community hospital and a proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Medical Center is one of the premier hospitals for orthopedic surgery and follow-up care. Whether you need your hip, knee, shoulder, ankle, or elbow fixed, our team of skilled physical therapists can help you regain your strength and get you back to your active lifestyle. Our physical therapists have access to the latest technology and equipment, like an anti-gravity treadmill and a SwimX therapy pool. We also offer free assessments for physical and occupational therapy. Call 435-658-7350 to make an appointment.
Voters are being asked to approve a $56 million Park City school bond. The Project for a Deeper Understanding presents a forum Tuesday, October 13th. The Park City school bond. Is it the right program at the right time? At 7 p.m. at St. Luke's Church. KPCW will broadcast the forum live. The Project for a Deeper Understanding on KPCW is made possible by a donation from Tesh Law, real estate, construction, and HOA law since 1989. TeshLaw.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with Tim Henney. We were just speaking with Nikki Thorson and Taylor Hanton from the Breast Milk Donation Bank at Park City Medical Center. Again, that's really fascinating. If you have any questions whatsoever, look up their website, Facebook page, or give them a call. Well, in Girl in the Woods, our next guest, Aspen Mattis, shares the trauma of being raped her second night at college and how that led to the choice to flee to the border with Mexico and begin a 2,650-mile hike of the Pacific Coast Trail in search of home and salvation. It's a memoir that teaches us that writing can be a way to heal, empower ourselves, and turn our worst experiences into a beautiful art, which Aspen Mattis has done. Aspen, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're really glad you could join us. And I'd like to go back into your childhood to begin with. And you were raised in this family of, it sounds like a kind of a fearful family, a can't-do family. Talk about that.
So I grew up in suburban Massachusetts. And both my parents had gone to Harvard Law School, and they were both lawyers, very accomplished. And it was a very stable and, in many ways, idyllic childhood. I'd never had to move. I'd lived in the same home my entire life until I was 18. And, no one I'd ever loved had died. It was pretty much safe and calm. And I was very connected to my mother, and we would take walks together in the evenings through suburban Newton. I would say I was a fearful child more than it was a fearful family.
Right. I'm just curious about, why you think that was. I mean, a lot of people would say that the type of upbringing you had would be very empowering because you came from this place of stability and safety. But it was maybe just the way you came into the world?
Maybe in part just my nature, but also my mother was very competent. She was very swift and very efficient and an extraordinary woman. Like, she raised three children and had, and went to Harvard Law School and had a very successful law practice. And maybe my dynamic with her was just the path of least resistance was always to let her do things for me that I should have been doing for myself, because she was so competent and so swift, and she would just handle it for you. And I began to think that I wasn't capable of doing all of the things that she did for me that I really should have been doing for myself. And it wasn't like out of malice that she wasn't allowing me to do these things or anything like that. It was more that was the dynamic we developed. I was her baby girl. I had two big brothers.
Yeah.
Aspen, we talk about this theme quite a bit on our show, or we have recently. We did an interview with the author of How to Raise an Adult recently, and mm-hmm. I think it's just kind of a product of the time where this evolution of parenting has led to parents who think that they're empowering but are actually disabling children in certain ways, and that kind of plays out. And yet, you know, before you went off to college, you sort of made an attempt to step out on your own. You hiked sections of the Pacific Crest Trail, I believe twice. Was it the 2 years prior to going to college? And you didn't tell your parents about it one time because, well, why don't you just discuss that? Why didn't
That's
you
right,
tell your parents
right.
and what were you attempting to do when you sort of set out on your own?
Okay, so from this very, very protected and idyllic and safe childhood, there was one window into something other than that, something wild. Every summer, my parents would take us backpacking, me and my two big brothers, and later years, my oldest brother and his wife. And it was just incredible. We would fly out west, and we would stay at my grandparents' house in Colorado Springs, and that sort of became our base camp. Mm-hmm. And we would go backpacking, and it would usually be like a week or even 10 days out in the wild with my mom and my dad and my brother. And my dad would catch fish, and my mom would fry the fish for us for dinner, and we'd pick berries, and we were like this little wild tribe, and it was us against the wild, and I loved it. Mm-hmm. And my dad would tell us stories in the tent, and we had his undivided attention, and my mom seemed so much less nervous out there. And it sort of became, in my mind, this place where we were, like, unified. Like, our family knot was tied tight, and it was us against the wild. And I loved it so much.
So that was your empowerment, the place that you weren't afraid, the place where you felt, and it must have even tied the whole West into that. And ironically, the decision probably that you made to go to Colorado College in Colorado Springs, where on your second night there you were raped, which is, it just kind of flies up in the face of everything that you loved about the West and hiking and being out there. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So when it came time to apply to colleges, I applied to only one, and that was Colorado College. I was so sure that I wanted to go there. I associated it in my mind with these summers and with, like, hiking with my dad in the bluffs. And I remember the first time I saw the campus from the top of the bluffs over Colorado Springs, like this, like, green field glowing in the distance amid just tons of, like, red rock and brown. There was, like, this one glowing green field, and I was like, Dad, what's that? And he was like, that's Colorado College. And, like, I had no association with Colorado College, like, not good, not bad. But when I saw it, I was just sure that I had to go there because it looked beautiful. And it was, like, the school in the place where I loved to spend, like, where I thought I wanted to spend my life.
Well, and good for you. You didn't choose a safety school like most kids do, and Colorado College is hard to get into.
Thank you. Well, I think my parents, like, probably, well, in retrospect, they're certainly right. I probably should have applied to more than one school. But
but when you're sure, you're sure, which was pretty courageous.
Thanks. Or reckless or silly, but
Aspen, when you look back.
I'll go with Grace.
Yeah.
When you look back at it from where you are now and you see, you know, your idyllic sheltered life and cloistered life in Massachusetts and then stepping out and heading off to college, and it's, I mean, I don't know how to phrase this exactly, but sometimes, you know, the path that opens up before us and the one that opened before you has to do with fears, and your mom's greatest fear had to have been realized when this traumatic event happened with you, and probably your greatest fear as well. And looking back, can you kind of make sense of why the greatest fear that you and your mom would have held for yourself would have been what happened?
Yeah, so I would say half of what you said is absolutely true. I'm sure that this was my mom's greatest fear. She had spent her entire... my entire life, I should say, vigilantly protecting me. And then the minute I left home, the worst thing that could have happened happened. But it had never been a fear of mine. I had never, like, walked around in fear of being raped. I didn't think that rape was a threat, you know. It had never even occurred to me that that would be something I should be worried about.
And do you think maybe that juxtaposition of you having no concern about it and it being your mother's greatest fear is what enabled that to happen, to come to fruition?
No. I mean, I'm not sure. I think that I don't think that fearing rape more prevents rape. I think, you know, short shorts don't cause rape and weed doesn't cause rape. Rapists cause rape.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Aspen, you know, it's a hard thing to even ask you to talk about. So I want to talk about sexual assault on college campuses in general. And as you know, with a lot of the information coming out, a lot of colleges have done little of nothing, have acted like, oh, it didn't really happen, have protected the perpetrator. Talk, if you would, about that in general and maybe how Colorado College in particular handled it.
Yeah, so I reported the assault to the college, and I went through the college's conflict mediation process as if rape could be mediated,
a
violent felony could be mediated like a playground fight. So I didn't really realize when I was 18 how absurd that was already.
Right.
But I absolutely didn't realize exactly what you were just kind of alluding to, which was that colleges have an inherent conflict of interest. They don't necessarily, or they absolutely do not, it's not in their best interest to have a rape conviction on campus. Colleges have brands, and they put a lot of money into the creation and protection of their brands. And it's just a fact, unfortunately, that they would rather have a rapist on their campus, a boy who is raping girls on their campus, than to have it known that a rape occurred on their campus. They would rather obscure justice and protect their brand and their value in that way, than to have the truth come out. So when you go behind the closed curtain at a college through a conflict mediation process or whatever that school calls it, it's very, very unlikely that they will find him to be guilty or that they'll even care to find out what happened and find the truth.
You never returned to Colorado College, right?
I actually did.
You did?
But I returned there. I returned there a few times. I returned there the spring semester of what would have been my sophomore year, and took classes there for that semester, which was just inertia. That was me not knowing what to do other than to go back there.
Right.
So, Aspen, what about the hike? What moved you to, how did that play out? What were the decisions that you did make and led you to find yourself on the border of Mexico, beginning on, I guess, the very first step of the Pacific Crest Trail?
Right. So I had always, not always, but for years I had known of the Pacific Crest Trail, and I was absolutely mesmerized by the concept of it. It's a continuous footpath that runs from the Mexican border through the Mojave Desert and the High Sierra Mountains of California, and then the volcano lands of Northern California, up into Oregon, up into the Cascades of Washington, all the way to Canada for 2,650 miles without ever once breaking or stopping. You could literally walk the height of the country. And I was so, like, enchanted by that notion. And I thought, I always thought, I'll do this someday. Someday I'm gonna walk the PCT, the whole thing. But I thought it would be like if I lost my job when I was older or when I retired. I didn't think I could do it then because I was going to go to college. But then after the school found my rapist to be innocent, which meant that I was guilty of lying, and then the school moved him from the other large dormitory across campus into my dormitory. They later said because of a glitch, that it wasn't malicious, but even if it wasn't, that incompetence is really deeply disturbing as well. Then I kind of realized that my school was not going to help me, and that my parents really couldn't help me. There was nothing they could do to undo this. And I really had to help myself, and I had to leave this place. And this infrastructure that I'd believed so deeply in my whole life, yeah. College and Colorado College especially, was failing, and it had cracked. And I couldn't stay, and I decided to do what I had wanted to do for so long. I finally didn't have a reason not to do it. The reason to do it seemed stronger than the reason not to, finally.
And when exactly did you do that? Was that after you had gone back sophomore year, or was this during freshman year?
During freshman year, yeah. It was, I left in the spring of my freshman year with just only 4 weeks of school left. In my freshman year, I left, and I flew to L.A., and my parents were incredibly, astonishingly supportive, and I think that they understood that this was the one way that they could support me and help me, because you can't, there really is nothing you can do as a parent to correct a rape. And my dad flew to L.A., he took vacation to fly to L.A., and he drove me down through the desert, to California's border with Mexico, and along the corrugated metal border fence that ripples along the border as far as you can see in either direction, he dropped me off among hills of dust and drove up the dirt road north away and left me there with a little backpack and a little 11-pound backpack and a bunch of bottles of water and lots of candy.
A lot of people die out in that desert trying to cross the border illegally. And it's not the most beautiful section of the Pacific Crest Trail, I would imagine. So did you ever, I mean, A, were you scared of being alone? And B, did you ever say, oh, this was a huge mistake?
All the time and all the time, at least once a day. But it wasn't so much that I was scared of being alone, that as much as that I was scared of where I was going. Like, I knew that I could put one foot in front of the other and I could put one foot in front of the other, but I didn't necessarily see how crossing this desert was going to get me to a better place ultimately, because the fact is that the trail really isn't a destination. It's just time with yourself, and wherever you go, there you are. And really, it was my responsibility on the trail to myself to figure out for myself what I needed to do to make myself happy again and to feel safe in the world again, in the body that I had to live in.
Yeah. And Aspen, how about your view of men? I would think that you had a certain perspective on men and boys prior to your rape at college, which would have profoundly, I think, shifted, I'm making an assumption, shifted your view of men. And then maybe you've had a subsequent shift to that. Could you explain that process?
Well, I'd never really dated. I was kind of a late bloomer. I never really had a boyfriend in high school. It wasn't that I wasn't interested. I think I was just scared. Like, I was just awkward and terrified of boys in the way that, you know, high school girls, some of us are. And I'd actually lost my virginity that summer going into college, just 6 weeks before the rape. So in 6 weeks, I went from virgin to rape victim. And
how was that when you then were on the trail, encountering, I would think, mostly men?
That's right, yeah. So the other fact about the PCT that I knew, but I didn't really let myself know and, like, let myself think about fully before I began this journey, was that I really wouldn't be alone all the time. There's a whole community of people who attempt this journey, and they all start off at the Mexican border around the same time, kind of in, like, the spring, late spring, kind of at a big party just north of the Mexican border called Kickoff. And most people finish in September. It takes about 5 months. Mm-hmm. And it's a pilgrimage, and it's a community, and it's a subculture. And approximately 9 men attempt this walk for every 1 woman. So of the about 400 people who attempted it the year I did, 2009, it was about 9 men to 1 woman. And so I had fled the world of college into the only place in the universe where men multiply and women divide.
Yeah.
So I fled it literally into a world of men, like a girl among men in the desert and then in the woods. And it was a very specific sort of form of immersion therapy that I, again, like, knew in theory I was signing up for, but didn't know what it would be like.
Wow. Aspen Mattis is our guest. The book is Girl in the Woods, and you say this is the story of how your recklessness became your salvation. And Aspen, I feel like we've only just started this conversation. I wish we could go on, but we're out of time. I guess our listeners will just have to purchase your book and find out about this amazing journey that you're on. And I just want to congratulate you and also thank you for, gosh, your courage in telling this story. It's obviously, you know, not something that a lot of women could retell and relive through. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right. Best of luck, Aspen. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Wow. That was really, really intense. And she is quite brave for getting out there. And
she writes beautifully.
Yes. Yes. It's really interesting. Really a completely different story than that of Cheryl Strayed's Wild, but, you know, obviously similar. It's still the Pacific Crest Trail, but she's very vulnerable, and wow, what a story. So I hope that our listeners will go on to read that, and we'll be right back after this.
Hi, I'm Dr. Bob Miller with Miller Orthodontics, a new sponsor on KPCW. Miller Orthodontics offer orthodontic care for patients of all ages. We provide a custom evaluation and offer flexible payment plans. Located in Kimball Junction across from Basin Rec, our website is m2ortho.com, 731-4111.
Hi, I'm Josh Carr of Park Meadows Country Club, sponsor of KPCW's The Mountain Life. Park Meadows, now managed by Stein Erickson Lodge, is a private country club located in town offering a Jack Nicklaus signature course, on-mountain facilities at Deer Valley, pool and fitness center. Golf and social memberships are available at 649-2460 or parkmeadowscc.com.